Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another Hit Save podcast. Today, we're going to talk about Japanese feature phone preservation and how that's going. Look back at 2023 and what's been happening so far in 2024. And to kick us off, we have three people on here. We've got Rockman Cosmo, Memory Hunter, and Krace. But I'll ask Rockman to do a brief introduction of what a Japanese feature phone is, and then I'll let you all introduce yourselves.
Yeah, so basically, a Japanese feature phone is, so imagine a dumb phone, like a flip phone from the early 2000s, except it's not just any, like, feature phone is kind of like a broader term for dumb phones at large, but we say Japanese feature phone because the feature phones in Japan had really, really good processors. They also had some interesting features, like some of them could open horizontally, some of them could split in two. Like, they had a lot of crazy features, and they're really only present in Japan. So when we focus on Japanese feature phones, we're referring to those kinds of devices and not just dumb phones and, you know, flip phones at large.
Awesome. So with that, Rockman, let's introduce you, and then Memory Hunter, and then Krace.
Yeah, hi, I'm Rockman Cosmo. I am the leader of Scilab Secrets, which is also known as just the team that has preserved a bunch of lost Rockman feature phone games. And yeah, for about the past 3 years, I've just been advocating for Japanese feature phone game preservation at large. And I've been working alongside great people like Memory Hunter and Krace, and it's just been an incredible journey so far. I've written for HitSave some informational articles as well. So yeah, I'm happy to be on here.
Awesome. Memory Hunter.
Greetings, dear listeners. It's me, Memory Hunter. I'm one of the, let's just say, part of the de facto team at Coffee Break. That's one of the Discord servers, which is basically the, let's just say, a hometown to all of the feature phone preservation things going on. And I play a part in the whole preservation part. Specifically, I take the games out from the memory dumps, and then alongside with another user, Leonier, and him basically modify the code for the Java games to make them runnable on the emulator, and finally just archive it for the public. And a big thanks to HitSave for hosting me and my peers.
I love it. I love seeing the progress that you all are making here. It's fantastic. Krace.
My name is Krace. I run a YouTube channel dedicated to blue games preservation under the name of KRD1. The channel shows various games as run on ported hardware and also on Melange emulator. I was involved in preservation, and I am involved in preservation of Japanese feature phone games, and my specialty KDDI phones, which also run on Blue system.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You're all doing fantastic work here. So can you summarize a bit what happened in 2023 with regards to preservation of Japanese feature phones and their games?
Well, a ton of stuff happened, actually, spanning a bunch of different subjects, you know, types of games, where they came from. So I guess, what would you like us to start with first? Because there are definitely a lot of different things that happened in 2023.
I would say, looking at the blog post that you posted here, there were a lot of iMode games. We were looking at Gmode archives, iMode games on SD cards. I think that the biggest topic was the decryption part here. So maybe you want to dive into that first.
Yeah, I can speak on that. So basically, as I had touched on in the previous podcast episode, basically when Docomo games are moved to an SD card, you know, one would think the game files, Java files, would be on the SD card, and I can just put it into a computer and voila, I'm going to see the files. Unfortunately, that's not the case because they are encrypted with CPRM and the C2 cipher. So basically, that really presented a big roadblock for just getting these games that are already moved to SD cards, because, you know, we had no way of playing them for a while. And the only way to really access them was to decrypt them. And over a year ago, we had no idea how to do that. But now, at the time of this recording, I can say that it is definitely now possible to decrypt them. And I'll go through guess what happens when you do that? So basically, there are a few items that you need to crack this encryption. And basically, I will split it into three different things just so it's easier for you all to understand. So you need an S-box, a device key, and a bind ID. So the S-box is pretty simple. It's universal, and it was actually discovered on a Japanese Samsung Galaxy S2, weirdly enough, by a user named username AK. And that was about 2 years ago. But for a while, we were stuck on obtaining a device key because the device key comes from the phone. And then there's like this media key, immediate unique key. And you, in order to unlock those, you need that device key. So basically, we had to find a way to get this device key from a phone itself. And basically, that required brute forcing. And this great user named Good Tofu Friday in September of last year, he set out to brute force one of these device keys utilizing a program by username AK and Zer the Squirrel. And basically, about 20 days later, he brute forced like 34 billion keys a second. He finally obtained the key. And this is a really big step because this device key, just like the S-Box, is actually universal, which means it can be used across SD cards. But then there was one more hurdle, which is the bind ID. And actually, we don't know how the bind ID is generated, but we think it comes from the SIM card and the game itself. So that initially kind of scared us because a lot of these games that were moved to SIM cards, to SD cards, they didn't have the original SIM, which means that we can't get the data from the SIM to unlock the game. But interestingly, the bind ID can be derived from the SD card's device unique key, which is different from the device key. And that can be brute forced in a significantly shorter amount of time than the device key. So it doesn't take 20 days. It takes about, 3 to 4 days, which is still a good amount of time. But unfortunately, the program or the script developed by username AK to find this device unique key is pretty prone to false positives because it's brute forcing against 56 bits of known plain text with a 56-bit key. So really, it's more about ruling out potential keys than finding the right one, because the right key could be anywhere in this key space. So on December 30th, using a modified version of that aforementioned script, Zer the Squirrel and Good Tofu Friday once again tried to brute force this device unique key. And they started from opposite ends of the key space, and they ended up finding one. And that allowed us to decrypt a bunch of Rockman games that were on that SD card, including Rockman Tennis, and eventually Rockman Dash Great Adventure on Five Islands. But there is still one more technicality. The bind ID, unlike the device key in the S-Box, is not universal. In fact, it's specific to the SD card it came from, and it's also per SVC folder, which is basically means that it's per application that owns the game files. So when we got Rockman Tennis, we only got like the fifth chapter of Five Islands because the rest of Five Islands game chapters, they were in a different SVC folder because the data was owned by Five Islands itself and not the phone system. So basically, you're going to have to brute force a different bind ID for each SVC folder, which is also per SD card. So basically, in the future, if we do want to do any more brute forcing to find these games, we're really going to have to find a way that does not, we don't want to spend 4 days, for each SVC folder. So if we understand how the bind ID is generated, I'm sure we're going to be able to do something that does not require all that brute forcing. But long story short, it seems like we've really overcome that, what was previously an insurmountable hurdle.
I mean, that's fantastic effort. Just being able to dig into the cipher here, dig into actually decrypting it, making sure that you find the right keys and everything, and stumble upon it and see that, hey, this is actually universal. That's a real good stroke of luck there. The bind ID, I agree, sounds like a hassle to handle, absolutely. But not too much. If it takes 4 days, okay, it takes 4 days. But yeah, I understand that it would be annoying to do that all the time.
Yeah, I feel bad for Good Tofu Friday. He sacrificed that poor GPU so many times for us.
Maybe we can do something about that. So what else, when it comes to decryption, I mean, that's the big thing. But you also preserved iMode games through other means.
yeah, Memory Hunter, if you want to discuss the debug cable exploit.
Sure thing. So there are several ways that one can obtain these games from those phones. Well, basically, one of the, let's just say, default ways is to get yourself a Docomo cable. There are several versions of those cables, but we do have a sort of like a guide which will tell you which one to get for, you know, the easiest and best results. So the thing is, you get this cable, and then there are certain pins that have to be modified. It's sort of like a fast boot cable for Android phones. It's also like an old thing when Androids used to be on micro USB cables. But basically, you modify a normal USB cable and make it like a factory USB cable, so that this grants you extra access to the phone, if you will. Then there are certain scripts which was written by a user called XYZ. He's one of the security engineers. He's an extremely talented person, and basically without him, we wouldn't have come this far. So massive thanks to him for this, and a big shout out to him. Basically, using those scripts, we dump certain dump phones. Obviously, which this list is expanding continuously. If one just gets a phone which hasn't been looked into yet, XYZ is probably the only person as of now who can do that, because he knows reverse engineering extremely well. So he will look at this phone and determine certain values, and probably even sometimes write new methods for a specific model. And then by that, basically, I get the dump of a phone by whoever has the phone. Then I process this raw dump through a thing called file translation layer. It's sort of like the OS automatically manages the data on the chip so that the chip wears evenly. So nowadays, our PCs, we have these NVMe or SATA SSDs, and these guys have their own chips specifically designated so that when there's some sort of input or output going through the bus, this chip manages where to write on the NAND chips that are on your SSD. But certain chips for this specific thing was, I think, a bit expensive back in the day. So the developers resorted to implementing that layer onto the operating system. The fun fact is, most of those phones were under Linux. It was quite a surprise, not going to lie. I always thought that it was some kind of like extremely rudimentary, easy thing. It just implemented for phones, but no, looks like under the hood, it was all Linux all this time. So because of this, it actually made it much easier for the tools to be developed. So basically, but there are scripts as well. So since we get this raw dump and the data is just all over the chip, basically, an FTL script basically rearranges all of those in a PC readable format, such as FAT file system, and then that's just simply openable with basic tools on your Windows PC, or for the matter of fact, any sort of x86 machine. And then we get the games from it, and then me and Leonir, as I mentioned, we take a look at the Java bytecode, and if there are any sort of online authentication that has to go through, because obviously these games were subscription based back in the day, as that's the way the iMode service operated. We remove that, and since we already have the data downloaded on the phone originally, the server shouldn't actually go through the download all over again. So the authentication skipped, there's no need for download, voila, we're in the game through the emulator, and we can play the game as it if were on the phone, basically. This is one way, and this is the, let's just say, the mostly used way. There are other ways to get iMode games, specifically ports for Android phones or any other device, for example. Nowadays, the modern part of that is Gmod Archives, which and these guys release games on Nintendo Switch and for PC as well. Now, that's, I think, I extremely and thankful for them to do, because that's basically preservation in the most perfect way, basically. So basically back in the, I guess, 2010s around there, when there was this transition phase, when the feature phones were flushed out because, well, we got iPhone or we got Android and touchscreen and all of that. So people obviously were going to migrate to all of these stronger and better devices. Now, all of those games somehow obviously needed a layer of some sort of compatibility for them to be played on Android phones. So, for example, the first commercial game that was archived was Flyhide Claudia, and username AK. He got the game from the Android executable itself, did some mumbo jumbo with the bytecode that was in there because it was some kind of custom Java bytecode. It's not like the, let's just say, the usual one. And he, basically, we arrived to the point to which we had a commercial game runnable on the emulator. So the same sort of thing basically happened when we got games from the PS Vita archives. This, I think, was also released by Gmode and other companies. And at first, I took a look at these, and it seemed to emulate the server which the games originally downloaded the data from. Obviously, these were down and not available anymore. So presumably and logically, the developers on the PS Vita would have implemented some sort of way to, you know, feed the data in there. Since it's kind of troublesome to edit the compiled game itself, unless obviously you have the source code, it's just better to emulate the server, have the same sort of file directory and file placements as it were originally, so the game can start. The when it tries to access some kind of link, you can just redirect that to the local server that you're emulating and download files from there. That I noticed when I disassembled one of the, I think there were some kind of DLL basically from the decrypted game. And then I thought, is there any kind of way to maybe emulate a server where we can like put these files? And then LNRC, one of our friends over at Calvary Break as well, suggested XAMPP. And that straight away just clicked in my head. And I was like, how did I not think of that? And what do you know? I loaded up XAMPP, put the files in there, and the downloads worked. And fortunately, some of the games straight away just launched. So yeah, that's one of the ways as well. Obviously, we talked about the SD card decryption. I guess that's pretty much it, right? I summed up all of the ways, I think.
Yeah. And I just also, with regards to the Gmode archives, those are actually Unity recreations of the games.
Oh,
we'll
yes.
get to emulation later. But yeah, and I think I also just want to quickly highlight some of the games, because I'm sure some listeners might be wondering, well, that's cool. You got the games off. Well, what games did you preserve? You know, and it's also one more thing, the debug cable that Memory Hunter was talking about, where they modify it and they plug it in, boots into like a maker mode, and it dumps the internal contents. That only works with Docomo phones. Craze will talk about KDDI phones and later on. But yeah, some
yeah,
of the
forgot
games
to specify that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, no worries. So I'll just quickly highlight some of the games that were preserved. I'm obviously biased, but we did preserve like 9 Mega Man games with this. So that was really good. Like the Rockman.exe Phantom of Network and Legend of Network, which were 2 Mega Man Battle Network games. Like these are like full games that are just squished onto a cell phone. We were able to preserve them in their entirety. And it was funny because Memory Hunter was mentioning how the subscription check is in there. And what happened was, when we dumped the games, the owner told us, I only bought the first chapter of Legend of Network and only like up to chapter 3 of Phantom of Network. So when we dumped them, we saw that the game started off at chapters 1 and 3 respectively. And we were just like, okay, it's only going to go up to this. But after we released the files, people started playing through the games and they started getting to chapter 4 and then chapter 5. Then chapter 6, and I'm realizing, wait a minute, did we just preserve the full games without realizing it? And it turns out that, yeah, behind that subscription check, these were actually full games. So once that subscription check is gone, like, usually the game would be like, okay, now go to the site and go buy chapter 4. But now that's not checked anymore, it turns out that Capcom just sneakily shoved in all the game files and just paywalled them. So that was a really great surprise. But even some other really good games have been dumped. Like, for example, Final Fantasy Legends, which I think was called Final Fantasy Dimensions when it was localized. Or like Final Fantasy IV, The After Years. Now, those were not full games because, unfortunately, between each chapter, it would go to the server, check with it, and then download another chapter. So basically, we just kind of got miscellaneous chapters from those two games. But nonetheless, they are kind of somewhat half-preserved in their original forms. And of course, there's something called Biohazard the Stories, which is a Resident Evil game with its own little original story. We got a demo for that. And then even some of the preloaded applications that I had mentioned before on the previous podcast have been preserved. Like I think, was it Dirge of Cerberus? Lost Episode, which was like a mid-quill between Final Fantasy VII and that interesting PS2 game, Dirge of Cerberus. And that's like a third-person shooter, and its demo was also preserved with that debug cable. And actually, Memory Hunter, if you want to quickly hop in, you discovered something interesting about what the programmers did for Dirge of Cerberus Lost Episode.
Oh yes, that's a marvel to tell. So, let's talk about the specification of the games themselves. Originally, the Doja, which was called Docomo Java, basically, it was not straight away just G2ME, the normal, what we got in, here in Europe, or I'm not sure if there were any J2ME phones in US, but basically not the conventional J2ME, right? So these guys re-implemented some of the functions and obviously added on top whatever they wanted, such as 3D functionality and other stuff that was connected to the hardware of the phones themselves. And these guys basically had profiles, and these profiles would be updated per version as they were released. So they started from Doja 1.0 up to 5.1, and then they rebranded to Star, and that went up to from Star 1.0 to 2.1, as far as I'm aware. And then these guys had specifications and about sizes of those games. So essentially, there are three plus parts to a Doja game. First is the JAM file, which is the descriptor of the certain sizes of the JAR file, which is obviously the Java archive, and you have all of the compiled classes in there and all of that stuff. And then there's also a thing called SP file, which is a scratchpad file. So essentially, you got this RAM-like free space on which you can temporarily put data on and then replace on the fly as you want. It's sort of like a semi-persistent storage, basically sort of like a RAM. And on top of this, so the JAM file has all of the specifications in there. It's the size of the JAR file and the size of the SP file. The SP file can be divided up to 16 parts at max. So that was basically, if you wanted to make your life easier, to let's say there's one bank of Scratchpad where I write my settings into, there's the second bank where I write my images, for example, and so on and so forth. Whatever you want to do, you are free to do so. And these guys were limited to a certain size. But the most common profile that we're working with is the Doja 5.1, and that has a tops of 1 megabyte, as far as I remember. So JAR file plus DSP file. So those guys cannot exceed a megabyte, which is extremely small by any means, not to mention in the early 2000s. Even by that time, there were sizes up to gigabytes already for conventional storage. So here's what the developers did. Let me just tell you the whole story of how we got to all of this. So we dump P903i, and it has the Dirge of Cerberus. Everybody's celebrating. Yay, we got Final Fantasy. Damn, man. First, we have the hurdles, because apparently some of those games which have extra features such as 3D acceleration, Bluetooth, all of that stuff, you need to explicitly give them permission in the emulator to run. So at first, there were errors that I didn't understand. It's a security violation. What am I violating? That I dumped the game from the phone and I'm trying to run it on an emulator? So then I delve into the code and find some clues, and I finally figured out that the I should have given the permission. And voila, the game started. And again, in the next round of, you know, celebrations come in. And then I press the play new game. And then it asks me for an image. I was like, what kind of image file are you talking about, man? I mean, when I play on the phone, you just get into the game, right? What kind of an image file do you need? Apparently, again, I went back into the code. And there was this line of code which basically opened up the internal image storage of whatever was on the phone. And it got an image with some designated ID. I wondered, why the hell do you need an image for? Then I went to the raw dump again, got the partition where the images are, and I scroll. I use the tool to dump any and all images, and I just scrolling past email emojis or some pictograms, whatever. And I finally get to a picture which has the title. Basically, it's an image of title, Dirge of Cerberus, Final Fantasy VII, last episode. And finally I arrived to something. Looks like there's an image with Final Fantasy stuff. I press next. It's the same image. I press next. It's the same image again. So 10 times the same image. I was extremely confused. Why are these even here? And plus, these are not even viewable on the phone. It's all hidden. And then I looked at the sizes, and they were 100 kilobytes each. I was like, something's going on here. And then username AK suggested that the GIF files have a comment section, so you can put like some kind of metadata in there. And apparently these guys snuck in another jar file in there. They split it up into 10 parts and just snuck it in there. And they circumvented the Dojo profile size limitations with this, and basically we took out each and every separate part and an actual jar file constructed into one whole thing. And then we had to figure out how to get those images basically lined up properly, and we had to be careful which part and which image we load in, because they're identified by some certain ID and whatever. We lined those up and the game started. It was a whole hurdle, but we got through it. And I really have to appreciate the creativity of those developers that thought of this. Crazy, crazy people, for real.
I just think it's hilarious that, first of all, that they thought of that. And then, of course, it worked. They used it to circumvent the storage sizes. And then you were able to figure it out and preserve even more games. I love it. It's so cool.
Yeah, the thing is, sort of like, as time moves forward and we break ourselves free from all those limitations, nowadays games are what? Hey, there's an update. You have to download 100 gigabytes of update files. And I think certain freedom creates creativity, because when you have an obstacle and you don't have a brute force way through it, you turn your brain on and you think something unimaginably beautiful. And that's the creativity and beauty of those engineers, and I really appreciate them. They made my life harder, but I appreciate them very much so.
Hey folks, podcast editor Jonas here. We had a bit of a hiccup during Krace's portion of the podcast, so I'm gonna let Rockman, Cosmo, and Krace talk a bit about the preservation work that he's been doing. Please enjoy, and then we'll come back to the rest of the podcast in a little bit.
My next question is, what exactly is a KDDI phone, an EasyWeb, and how does that compare to like iMode games?
Okay, so KDDI phones are phones which were serviced on KDDI's carrier. The service name was AU, and KDDI is the company which is the carrier of this service. Basically, EasyWeb was content and internet access service for these feature phones. So EasyWeb is obviously a way to access data services from the phones. And EasyApply is the name of the applications which run on these devices. So EasyApply on the difference from iMode are native applications and not Java. They are compiled to run on Blue middleware, and True Middleware was developed by Qualcomm and was promoted by them. And all those phones on KDDI carrier used Qualcomm manufactured chips, system on chip, GPU if you want. For me, using, extracting and preserving the applications from KDDI phones are easier than from the Docomo phones, because the technology which Qualcomm used in Japan was similar to the one it used in the US and the other parts of the world on in their devices. Basically, although these phones are also locked, be accessed from the PC as are the Docomo phones. Luckily, there was already existing solutions for Qualcomm devices, like several JTAG boxes for flashing and reading and writing firmware from those phones. To name a few of these are ReefBox, EasyJTAG, there's also Octoplus, Medusa boxes, which are specialized hardware and software for extracting and writing data to Qualcomm devices. Although the basic support is there, obviously it was not supported completely, and I had to reach the support and the programming guys of ReefBox, which I used to extract data from those phones, for them to add the support at least for some of the phones which couldn't be dumped as they were, with the available at the time loaders included with the ReefBox. Basically, what you need, first of all, we need to connect the phone with JTAG box. And the issue starts here because there are no documentation on the phones, and one cannot find the JTAG connection points easily. They are not routed to some port, they are just contacts on the board. As these are usually used only during manufacturing process and never used afterwards, they are not really user accessible or user identifiable. When I just started these researches, I knew only one way to have these points identified is to decap the system on chip from the board and then measure with the multimeter where each contact goes, with the continuity function of the multimeter. That's why when I started collecting those phones for the extraction, I had to purchase two of each. And just to say, often it is not, you can't easily find just one, but if you want to find two, it becomes more difficult. And one phone, it's, I call it a sacrificial phone. And the other one is the one which we will then extract the data from. Usually, I purchased one phone which was really broken and the cheapest one as possible. And the other one, I tried to find one which was completely broken, but he might have a usable board with content which the user wouldn't be able to remove, delete, or reset because the phone itself was broken. And I had to find another phone of the same model in good or perfect cosmetic condition, so I could swap the boards from one to another and use the one board from the reset phone as a way to remove the chip and pinpoint the pinout of tech points. Later, I was hinted by my other colleagues from Calibreak and from the Discord servers to non-destructible ways of finding pinouts. I also looked for help from ReefBox support. They also have ways to detect the pinout, but their way was not so straightforward as in other solutions. Like, there is a commercial solution which is named JTAGulator, which has a board which has very well developed software which helps in finding JTAG pinouts. You can detect, I think it's up to 20 or 30 points at the same time, contacts, because JTAG needs only 7 contacts, and in most cases these are hidden between other test points on the board. In some cases, the place is identifiable because it's like a place where a connector could be placed, or it's like a series of 8 to 10 contacts placed in one place. but we still need to know which contact is for which function. And here where the gtegulator comes in handy, it detects what point is where, and afterwards it's just a way to connect this contact via a ribbon cable to the gteg hardware. However, it is an expensive solution. It costs about $120 if you buy an assembled board, or about $60 if you buy it in unassembled. You can order a PCB. The PCB design is open, but still it uses some specialized chip, which is not cheap. It costs around $40. There is another solution to detect the pins, which is gteg enum. It's an open source solution, and basically gtegulator was based on this solution, which was adapted to mobile phone detection. So what I made is that I used the instructions on gteg page on GitHub to build this environment on the basis of an Arduino Pico, to be more precise. And then I used some cheap level shifting boards to adapt the device to mobile phones, because on the difference of the Arduino, which uses 5 volt, the mobile phones use 3 to 1.8 volts for the operation of GTEC. These are two ways to detect, which the first way was destructive and the other one is not destructive. However, even if with the non-destructive way, it is possible to break the board if you just poke into the wrong test point, like if you poke into the test point which delivers power, or when you are looking for a reset point, sometimes you need to look for some resistors near the CPU, and there is a risk that you can break either the CPU or the power delivering IC.
So even if it's destructive, it's also pretty tedious, basically.
Yeah. And also sometimes these test points are so small that you can't effectively work on them without a microscope. Like these Hitachi and Sharp phones are most notorious for that, because they used really, really small pitches between the contacts. Is it pitches, or how do you call it? The contacts are very small, and there is very small distance between them. So you can't, it's very difficult to work on them.
So I have a question. It's about like what games need to be preserved, but I feel like maybe before discussing that, it'd be good to discuss just like how some of the phones have like the two memory banks.
Oh yeah. Okay. So once we have figured out the physical part where we connect to the gteg board, there is an issue of, in fact, logical dumping of the data from the phone. In most cases, for the Western phones, it is rather straightforward. The Western phones rather early started to use single banks, and the data is just kept in one place on one chip. However, I have noted that the Japanese phones, as they were more sophisticated as their Western counterparts, the Japanese phones used either two chips or chips with two banks of data to bypass the technological difficulties where not very large amounts of data could be stored in the phone. So in some cases, although we can connect to the system on chip, we can't really extract user data from the phone. Currently, I have researched 33 phone models, and from these phone models, 20 were dumpable completely. 4 were not dumpable, as either the loader doesn't support them, or because it was not possible to detect the gteg pinout. 9 were dumpable with issues, mainly because we couldn't access the second bank of the data, which contains the applications and the other user data. We could only dump the firmware and the bootloader of these phones. This is one of the issues we encounter in data extraction and preservation. And basically, I have begun all this quest for Japanese KDDI phones because one user, ShadeMP, contacted me after seeing my YouTube videos about the possibility of extraction of a Final Fantasy game from KDDI's W51H phone. It was a game under the name of Before Crisis Final Fantasy VII. basically, later he provided me with the phones which he purchased from the Japanese auction Mercari. And unfortunately, we could see that the files might be there, but we couldn't access neither the games, the game itself, because Japanese KDDI phones are locked to the RYC card which they were activated. So in order to see what is on the phone, you need that specific card. And in order to run any installed games, you also need that specific RYC card. Obviously, when people sell their old phone, they don't sell them with the SIM cards or contracts. And once we managed to dump these W51H phones, it appeared that the second bank with the data is inaccessible, and it is still inaccessible as of now. So we don't even know if this game is on those phones or not.
I see. So it's basically different than what we are encountering with Docomo phones, where you can view the apps and you can even launch preloaded apps without any kind of a SIM card. But it seems like these KDDI phones, on the other hand, you need that IC card in order to just access the apps, but also just see what the apps are in general. So that means, I assume, that with this phone, you looked at the storage, and based on the amount of storage was used, you were able to deduce that, yeah, the game is probably there based on the amount of storage, right?
Yes, but it is only true for later models, because on the earlier models there was no differentiation in the storage for games or for something else, because it was like it showed storage occupied and free, and that's all. So it didn't specifically show the storage occupied by EasyApply games. By EasyApply data.
Oh, I see. So I guess that's another wrench in the gears then, isn't it?
Yep. And this W51H, it's specifically one of those phones, which doesn't show what is taken by EasyApply.
Oh, man. Yeah. Of all the phones they put before Crysis on, why did they have to do that one? Why couldn't they do like a W53S or something? You know, something that's actually dumpable.
Yeah. Why not something usable? It's the same as it was with Rockman's games, where we chose the phone which was the most locked from all the possibilities.
Yeah, we still can't dump that one either, the SH10C. It's like impossible.
No.
Actually, maybe it's kind of fun, actually, if you would tell the listeners, like, what did you do with the chip, right? Because you took the chip to a Ukrainian state lab, right?
Yeah, well, it's one of the lost media. One could tell, because I told this in the last interview, which was not recorded. So basically, with the SH10C phone, we tried the various methods to access the data, which, like, we tried poking with some OBEX programs, we tried poking with, I don't remember what we used. We tried some data loggers to see how does synchronization software operates with the phone. And finally, we decided just to take the chip off and try to read them with some device. But as it was, again, it was one of those chips to which there was no data sheets. There was no support from the manufacturer. There was nothing. And so I tried contacting one data recovery lab, which was the best one in Ukraine. It's the name is EPOS, and it's a very good data recovery lab, at least for the hard drives, for SSDs. And they also told me that they could potentially recover data from mobile phones, so I brought them this. It's not a state-owned company, but it's a private company, but it is a well-established and very old company, like from the 90s. They have developed their own software and even hardware to retrieve data and also to destroy data. It's like things which go hand in hand. And, well, they had made me desolder the chip, because they will charge too much for desoldering. But eventually they said that they couldn't extract. They just returned me the chip and said that they can do that without further elaborating whether they can do it because their software doesn't work or because they don't want to do it. I don't know. I prefer thinking that they knew that they couldn't do it with their own technical means, but they just didn't want to, like, make bad publicity or something like that.
I see. So trying to cover their tracks, basically, sneakily.
Yeah. So we eventually for that model, we get to purchase ICC reader device, an NAND reader device, and we managed to dump it's the first bank or the first sector of the chip, and it didn't cooperate further. And later, it even just died.
Oh man! Yeah.
Yeah. Luckily, we got the files from another phone, which was more cooperating.
Yeah, and that one was like the easy one, you know, debug cable, you just plug
in. And in fact, it was a surprise that the games were full versions, but just locked behind the paywall.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess on that topic about games, I guess going back to the KDDI games, we had mentioned before Crysis, and that one, of course, has not been preserved yet. But I guess on your end, what are some games that you've already preserved that were on KDDI phones?
Well, when I started all this endeavor, I have looked into all the manuals for all the phones. I have made a list of all the possible preloaded phones, preloaded games which could come with the phone based on the instructions manuals. And then I tried first to get the phones which had like interesting or well-known games. Like, obviously, there were phones with Tetris preloaded, there were phones with Pac-Man preloaded, and these were different versions which we know in the, at least, which I knew. Like, there were different types of Tetris, Tetris League, Tetris 1-2-3, Tetris Black, I think, Tetris Blue, Tetris Black, and there were, like, other known franchises like Monster Hunter, like Bomberman, like Fantasy. Other ones, there is a bunch of phones with Final Fantasy for the after years, which I don't think were made in the West. Dragon Quest III, Ace Attorney, Puyo Puyo, like that. Something like that. I also looked for like some 3D games, like Metal Gear Solid Mobile and Resident Evil Biohazard. Resident Evil 4 has made its way into the mobile phones rather early. It was first featured on Tokyo Game Expo, I think, in 2007. And then it was released on the Zeebo and iPhone and Android and everywhere you could think. But basically, this Japanese original version was never found, and I really wanted to get it. And so I found one phone which had it. I managed to purchase it. It was a Sony Ericsson phone, and luckily it was extractable, and unluckily it can't be run.
No,
because it requires it requires some additional work on Melange, and we don't know even what the problem is, because it just crashes without any explanation. And I can't run it on the phone itself, because that phone was reset and the files were just recovered from the files. And I don't even own this phone with running Resident Evil 4 game. It's just the files that we managed to get.
Oh, man. Well, I guess it is preserved in some form, but at the same time, it also...
Yeah, it is. Also not... We can't view it. We can't feel it. We can't touch it.
Oh, man.
But I guess it's better than Final Fantasy, that one, Final Fantasy, the Before Crisis.
Yeah. That game is in the worst position right now. I feel so bad for it. It's been, I think you were working on it before, like, the Mega Man games were even preserved. And then the Mega Man games get preserved, and that one is still stuck. So.
Yep.
So hopefully.
But I have, I have hopes for that, because our genius, the username Acape, said that he will work on how to access that data. Once he has enough time, he probably will find a way.
Oh, yeah, he's going to find a way, username AK. For listeners who don't know, he's one of the, as Chris said, geniuses of the Coffee Break community. You know, he's played a really big role in just helping us design programs to brute force stuff on SD cards and look through file systems and design tools for that. So, invaluable. So, if you're listening to this, username AK, you're awesome.
Yeah, well, very grateful to you.
you had figured out how to kind of sideload games on the W53S, but there's obviously a catch to that. And sideload currently not possible on the Docomo phones yet, but they're currently figuring it out. But I'm curious, like, how did you find a way to sideload, I guess, Brew apps? Well, in some fashion, I know it's not 100%, but I'm curious.
What it is possible is to patch out the firmware so that it doesn't really verify the test signature, which is together with the game, because in Brew you had to sign your files either with commercial signature or with a test signature. It is a requirement, and without that signature, the game not only it wouldn't run, it will even not register in the file system. It will be removed from the phone after the phone is rebooted. So what I made for most of the devices which I feature on my channel is that I patched out the check in the firmware, and afterwards we can load software to the phone via cable. As we have total access to the phone's data, I mean on those phones which just have only one bank of data on the flash IC, so we can dump the firmware, we can modify it, and we can re-upload it the same way we have dumped it. And so what I made is I found that basically as the firmware is Qualcomm's build, all those methods, all the signatures and the functions in the firmware which I have researched and which I found in the Western models, they are basically the same in the Japanese models. Again, with the limitations of the late Sony Ericsson phones, which used a compressed firmware, which I can't compress and modify yet, hopefully. So basically the W53S, it was one of the latest phone in the Sony Ericsson range which I have the possibility to modify the firmware and get it into the phone. I have patched out this check, and then I had to get the files somehow into the file system. This phone uses a modified version of FAT16 with some specific flash translation layer, which like puts the data in different places of flash, of the flash chip, flash IC, to reduce its wear. Basically, what I have done that I have extracted the files from this file system with the help of username case tool, which translates the flash translation layer in a better straightforward data, which can further be processed with other tools like test disk or commercial tools like AirData. So the later tools would extract the data from this file system image. And I chose several files which were similar in file size to my applications, which I wanted to sideload. I have found chunks of these files in the file system scattered all around the flash, and then I have made a map of these chunks of files, and I have replaced these chunks of files with my own chunks of files, edited the headers of the FAT system to reflect the change in the size, and so I could sideload like 3 applications. And as there were no really big games or big applications in the file system, it's like I managed to upload file manager, which doesn't run on the Japanese phones, and a custom application manager named AppUI, which was created by an MK. And with that AppUI, I was able to find some hidden stuff. And I was able to basically, once I have managed to run AppUI, it means that I can sideload something to the phone.
Ah, I see. So still work to be done, but I mean, I think this is a pretty
good advancement. Yeah, because we can't really. Another thing which was found, but it comes from another phone, which is a prototype phone, is that fact the prototype or engineering sample phones for KDDI had some specific menu which would allow to enable or disable data transfer via cable, and also enable or disable running applications independently of the IC insert. The second part I was able to find it with AppUI, because it's like made in a separate application, but the first part to enable data transfer is still
I see. Well, it's still very, I still think it's really good progress, and I'm sure that as the as time goes on, I think you're gonna find a way to get them all to work on there. I'm confident in your abilities.
Yeah, maybe not this phone, but maybe another phone, or maybe some, I don't know, maybe some prototype will be found which would allow side loading and which I could research and replicate on.
So, Craze, you're a wealth of knowledge around the KDDI phones and debugging them and dumping them. Thank you so much for all the hard work there. It's really, really cool to listen to you talk about this and dig into it through the blog post and through your videos. Thank you for doing that. I want to switch topic a little bit before we wrap up here. I know Rockman wanted to talk about SoftBank game preservation and also some of the emulators that can be used for these phone games.
Yeah, definitely. So SoftBank games are, well, it's kind of a complicated scenario because let's say I buy a phone off of an auction site, right? For Docomo phones, for preloaded games, at least, you don't need a SIM card to run those, but you need a SIM card to run the paid games. For KDDI phones, those easy web games, you need that SIM card to run the game at all, even if it's preloaded. Now, SoftBank phones, it's even weirder because if you're outside their 3G network, you cannot run pretty much any multimedia stuff. They actually call it the multimedia lock. So basically, if you're outside the SoftBank 3G network, which will shut down, well, on April 18th, so in one day, rest in peace, you can't launch games, the camera, or even use Wi-Fi. Yes, you cannot use Wi-Fi without 3G.
That's wild.
We call it the lock bank, by the way.
Yes, yeah, the infamous lock bank. And apparently, SoftBank was actually motivated to do this after Chinese people smuggled and unlocked Vodafone, Keitai. Because before it was SoftBank, it was Vodafone before they bought them. And basically, some Chinese smugglers would take out the phones and they'd sell them and they'd crack them. So basically, when SoftBank bought Vodafone's Japanese operations, they chose to lock these devices down to prevent the smuggling. So, yeah, that didn't really end so well if you want to play anything outside of the 3G network. So that's why it's really hard to play these SoftBank games on the phones themselves. But how do you dump them? And interestingly, some of the SoftBank phones, the architecture inside, as well as kind of the outside of the phone, it's almost identical to the Docomo phones. So for example, there's a SoftBank phone called the 930P, and that is basically a P01A. On the Docomo side, and they look identical too. So actually, the debug cable method that we talked about for Docomo phones are compatible with those select few SoftBank phones because they use the exact same charging port too. It's kind of funny how much they cross over. So very recently, like a couple weeks ago, we were able to, user Naoya Shinoda, he was able to dump this Klonoa 1, it's like a demo, a very short demo, as well as this other 3D Gundam game off of a SoftBank phone. And those are probably the biggest SoftBank games that have been dumped at the moment, along with the demo of East 1, I think. But yeah, it's kind of cool to see those ones dumped. And at the same time, other SoftBank phones face difficulties similar to what Craze was talking about, because you got to find the JTAG, the chips, all of that. So now you're probably wondering, well, how are you guys even playing these games on PC? Because we've alluded to this a bunch of times, and that's where we're going to get into the state of emulators, because it's actually a big challenge. Because basically, Docomo and SoftBank games, they both run on some profile based on Java Micro Edition, JME. As Memory Hunter said before, iMode games are on Doja, and then SoftBank's games are on like MIDP, J2ME with some custom API. So they're closer to like regular base J2ME games like the West. And then as Craze said, KDDI's Easy Web games, they actually ran on Java for like 4 years, but then they quickly switched to Qualcomm's Brew platform. So the vast majority of KDDI games, the Easy Web games, those are all Brew based. So currently the only usable emulator for Docomo Doja games is the Doja 5.1 SDK, which is an official emulator that Docomo used to test their in-house applications. Unfortunately, its emulation is not really perfect. It has big performance issues with 3D games, and some sound emulation problems. And it's probably because Docomo did not intend this emulator to run games. It was probably its own in-house, I don't know, stock app, something like that. And then luckily on the SoftBank side, things are a bit easier because they can run in J2ME Loader, which runs other Western J2ME games because they're closer to base J2ME. And also, SoftBank had their own in-house emulator called the Mexa emulator. And that one, I think they're... I'm not sure there are as many performance issues with that one, but it's kind of funny that we also have that one. But unfortunately for Craze, EasyWeb Games get the short end of the stick because there is only a single emulator for it. As he said before, it's called Melange, and it's developed by username AK, who's really, really great guy in the feature phone preservation space. And yeah, it's just one developer, one emulator, and it's partially compatible, and there's no sound support yet. So as more EasyWeb games hopefully eventually get dumped, username AK will be able to expand on Melange and make it a more comprehensive emulator. But yeah, that's currently what we have at the moment. But a quick note on the future. As I said before, there's a user named Zer the Squirrel, and they are working on an emulator called Squirrel JME, which hopes to be like a all-inclusive Java virtual machine, as well as a RetroArch core. And that would basically support Doja games and the SoftBank games. Basically, it would alleviate all the emulation issues for them. So they've been working on this since 2016, and these recent iMode and SoftBank game dumps have really helped them make progress on the emulator. So hopefully we'll see that finish within the next, I don't know the time frame, maybe 2 to 3 years. I'm sorry, Zer, if you're listening to this, that I'm stepping on your toes. But yeah, that's the current state of emulation, though.
That's really cool. Yeah, I got to try some of these emulators myself. This is really, really cool to see. So I would like to wrap up this fantastic, very, very tech-heavy, engineering-heavy podcast. This has been so much fun listening to you all explain in detail how Japanese feature phone game preservation works. It's been really, really cool, and I hope all the listeners think so too. So before we sign off, can you all let everyone know where to find you on the internet and where to find more information about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter, not X, at Rockman Cosmo. That's just Rockman C-O-S. I also have a website, rockmancosmo.weebly.com. I post some of my progress on there. And yeah, I'm also on Discord, the exact same username. And yeah, really, I just like talking and spreading the word about this in addition to doing work like these people, but not as technical as them. I'm more of one to explain it all. But yeah, I really appreciate having me on. Also, I will be speaking on this subject at the Strong Museum of Play in August. Jonas will also be there. So like, don't come there for me. Come there for him.
But come there for everyone else.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. So in case you want to see me talk about this live, I might even bring a phone or two. Feel free to look up the details for that. I'm sure they'll be released in the near future. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
For me, you can find me on Twitter, Memory Hunter, but it's written in a weird way. So like M3M0RYHUN73R. Yeah, whatever. Just type in Memory Hunter, you'll find me. And on Discord, it's memory.hunter, all lowercase. And I encourage all of the listeners to join in Coffee Break and also spread the word. You know, if you find a phone yourself, or if you know somebody who has a phone and has some sort of a game, albeit a AAA one, a small one, an indie game, whatever, let them know that they can be dumped, get them over here, and we'll help them out to dump the game and you know, enrich the archive as much as we can. Thanks for hosting me, Jonas.
I'm present on Twitter. I have, as I already told, I have a YouTube channel at KRZBrew. It is the same handle as on Twitter, and I also have a coffee page at KRZBrew. Donating me will help me in research Japanese phones, in purchasing Japanese phones, and also making stuff which might be of interest for you and featuring on my channel, like more brew games, more modifications or software modifications, etc. Follow me, look my videos, visit my coffee page. Hopefully you'll find your interest in what I'm doing.
Fantastic. Thank you all of you here today, Rockman, Cosmo, Memory Hunter, and Craze. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And thank you all, listeners. I hope you have a great rest of your week, and we'll see you soon. Bye.